In a perfectly executed arrest, my detectives arrested James Joseph DeAngelo, 72 years old, living in Citrus Heights.
The White House today doubled down on its support of Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary nominee Ronnie Jackson as the embattled doctor continues to face allegations of improprieties. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders explained some of the background checks that Jackson has already taken part in.
Dr. Jackson has undergone four separate background checks, one that was conducted by the FBI, and all of those revealed nothing.
This is USA Radio News.
Okay, so the big question for any decision you're going to make, is this actually going to work? Well, if you've heard about MediShare, which is a brilliant way of sharing health care costs, you may have wondered that. Does it work? Well, so did Dr. Stuart Hoover, who initially joined to save a lot of money. The typical family saves about $500 a month. Stuart saved even more.
When we first joined MediShare, we were immediately going from a little over $1,600 a month down to $460 basically a month.
So that's wonderful, but then his wife needed emergency surgery and the bills added up to $160,000.
So we were seeing the bills coming in, and then the bills were being paid. Portions were being shared, and the end result of this is this bill was taken care of.
Yes, MediShare works, and it's so easy to get your questions answered too. So why not? You can call right now, 833-39-BIBLE. That's 833-39-BIBLE, 833-39-BIBLE.
Google's giving Gmail a makeover. USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes has more.
Google's parent company Alphabet revealing the new design, the first since 2013, and calling it an expensive overhaul that was 2 years in the making. The new Gmail, designed to compete with Microsoft Outlook and has smart assistant features.
Welcome to Destination Hockey. My name is David Lazar, and today we have a very special guest on the show. We have Sean Grandy, who is a great voice of the Boston Celtics. He's done so much in the broadcasting journalism world, and I'm very thankful to have him on. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure to do it.
Okay, so first, would you be able to introduce yourself a little bit? Because to some of our hockey fan listeners, you aren't as active in the hockey world as you are in basketball. So if you'd be able to just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, there's a great irony in that in so many ways, because my path when I was growing up in New York was, you know, probably my dream job. I'll start by saying it. I don't care if it causes trouble. I was the biggest Ranger fan there was, and that was my dream job.
Wow. Growing
up. And we will talk about how the Islanders destroyed my childhood, you know, later. We can get to it. But, you know, it was I'm a New York City kid that, you know, like a lot of New York City kids, our athletic opportunities are limited in New York because your knees are pretty much done by the time you're 10, being scraped up trying to play all the different sports that are on concrete or whatever. And I knew I wanted to get to the major league somehow. And the two things that captivated my attention as a kid were the players and the broadcasters. And that was my goal from the time I probably couldn't hit a fastball anymore. When I realized second base for the Mets was not going to happen, then I kind of aimed at the broadcast booth and been lucky enough through, you know, a lot of hard work and lucky breaks and whatever to get some opportunities and fool everyone enough to make a living at it for quite some time now.
That's great. And one thing that you're very unique about and you're known for is definitely your versatility. After doing a little bit of research, it really is apparent that versatility is basically your middle name, because you have done the cycle of the broadcasting world. You've done the NBA, the NFL, the NHL, WNBA, and even MLS games. So what has that been like to be able to dip your toe in all these sports?
Yeah, Kenny Albert is a good buddy of mine. We often joke that the two of us could do the Olympics, just the two of us, you know, between all that. We could probably cover everything there is to cover. And it's funny because now that I've started doing some combat stuff the last couple of years and do MMA and boxing this past year, I'm not really sure what's left. I think there's like golf maybe and horse racing, and I'm sure there's like, I guess, curling. Now that the U.S.
is dominating
curling, I guess we're going to have to start looking into that. But I think the way I usually answer that question is, you know, when you're just doing like seminars and the people who want to be broadcasters. You get a big room of kids who want to do this for a living or something like it. And if I'm doing it, say, in Boston, you say, how many of you want to be the voice of the Boston Red Sox when you grow up? And, you know, 2/3 of the hands go up. Well, there's basically two jobs for that. And 60 of you just raise your hand. So the point is, if you are prepared in every possible sport, maybe it's the Red Sox that call and that's your dream job's going to happen. Or maybe it's the Winnipeg Jets. Or maybe it's the Arizona Cardinals. Or, you know, and so on and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. And you've got to be prepared to do different things. I was, as a kid, I don't know which sport I would call my number one sport. But I was a baseball, hockey, football guy. And basketball was my distant number four. Wow. And for the last 20 years, I've been in the NBA. Because that's how it happens. And I remember the year that I was probably ready to go, which was, you know, 20-some-odd years ago, and 20 years ago now, when it was clear that this was my path, that I was kind of ready to go major league. Two jobs opened that summer were the new expansion Nashville Predators and the Minnesota Timberwolves TV job. Those are the two that happened to open, and I don't really remember anything about Nashville other than Minnesota happened very fast. That was the path that I ended up on. And, you know, I've had, you know, hockey was probably my first love. It really was in many ways. And you know, there's always flirtations, and you're always kind of looking over the wall at opportunities. But the answer to your question is, the more things you can do, the more things you can do. the advantages, the opportunities to you will increase by the number of different jobs and different skills. If you're a play-by-play guy, that's one thing. If you're in studio, whatever it is, the more skills you have, particularly now in the age that you're coming up, and with podcasts and the internet, and there's just everybody is learning different ways to approach their job, and jobs change over the course of years. So the more things you can, I think that's one rule that holds true no matter what year it is. The more things you can do, the more things you can do.
Yeah, I was at Hofstra University this weekend on a tour, and they were telling me about all the great opportunities you can have with the Islanders because they're 2 minutes away. And one thing that was interesting is I was asking, because I know a lot of people in the Islanders world, and one thing that I've noticed is when I thought that I was close enough with a connection to ask for something, whether it be a shadowing experience, to get a press pass or something, more than just an interview, I was ignored or shot down or something. And one thing I learned this weekend was that I'm a high schooler. You know, they want kids in college who are, you know, trained in everything. At Hofstra, there was a student who was a engineering student who the Winnipeg Jets radio engineer didn't show up to work one day. They called the college. They were like, yo, can you come down? And he just went down and engineered their entire broadcast. So knowing everything, being versatile is so important because there's so many kids, there's so many people who want to go into this. You got to really know how to do everything. So that's really interesting you said that.
And you never know when this is probably the first time in my life I've had I've had a conversation with the Winnipeg Jets came up twice in 5 minutes.
So oh, my God.
To have conversations about that. Hey, listen, I'm old enough to remember when the Winnipeg Jets came into the NHL.
Yeah, Thrashers and everything.
I remember it. And,
that's funny because the Jets are really, in the hockey world, I've talked about them on the show a few times. They are making headlines this year as one of the up-and-coming young teams. And they're almost like, they're not really like the Celtics of the NHL, but they are up-and-coming. They made some trades. They acquired Paul Stastny. They're kind of a team that has a new look, and they're making headlines. So that's kind of interesting that we bring them up. But moving on to the Boston Celtics, as you said, they have a rich history, and they really are one of the teams that, you know, in the NBA world, they're at the top. What's it like working with a team that has more history than I could even name, or, you know, anyone could even name? They're really a great franchise.
You know, I think it means something, and I think if you were, you know, I did something very unusual when I came to Boston, which is I left a TV job in the NBA for a radio job. And, you know, there were circumstances connected to that, but it had a lot to do with the franchise, and that was no knock. I was, you know, very proud to be with the Timberwolves. And when I was 26 or 27 when I went to the Timberwolves, and I thought I'd be happy being there my whole life. But, you know, when the Boston Celtics or the Rangers or the Canadians or an original six team in the, you know, the NHL, or the Dallas Cowboys, and there are franchises that still have a little extra cachet to them, and there's a different standard that's connected to them in many different ways. And it does, you know, it does mean something. You're very aware of the history. When we, you know, as a franchise, as a team, as an organization, retired Paul Pierce's number last month, you know, you are, you get connected to the history that way, and how important those things are. When you see the guys walking back into the building that have had their numbers retired, and you know, you kind of appreciate that. There are not a lot of, you know, you don't see three-part 30 for 30s over the summer on the Sacramento Kings. Mm-hmm. So you're a guardian of that history. It's important.
Yeah, and you have actually managed to become a part of that history, especially for modern-day Celtics fans. I know if I was a Celtics fan living in Boston, you would be one of the people I've heard all my games from on the radio. Only the legendary Johnny Most and the current television voice, Mike Gorman, have called more Celtics games for the team in their history, which is crazy considering how long they've been a member of the NBA. So how does it feel to be a part of such great company for such a great organization?
Well, it's mixed. On the one hand, it's like, it's an honor, it's really cool. On the other hand, there's guys like you at your age, like, hey, I've been listening to you my whole life. I remember the first time I had someone say, I've been listening to you since I was in high school. And then your, like, back starts hurting and you start going, it's a strange, you're always older than you think you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a general rule of thumb. You know, no matter what age you are, you always think of yourself as young as a kid. I'm in a strange place that way, which is, you know, I'm not really, I seem old to you, I'm sure, but I'm not, in the grand scheme of things, I'm not really old, but I'm not young anymore. So you're kind of caught in between, you know, where you are, like in your life, trying to balance all the experiences and the professional experience and always trying to keep up with the changes that, and so it's a really interesting thing that people, I don't think anyone really teaches about play-by-play specifically, and to some degree sportscasting, which is that we live in a very narrow demographic world now. TV shows are aimed at men 35 to 43, or, you know, women 20. When you are the voice of a team, or generally in a lot of sports jobs, you are speaking to an audience of 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
of men and women of all different economics. So it's sort of interesting. You have to be... it's, you know, it's like the old game, you know, the old game Twister, where you're trying to reach across, the, I'm showing my age, you're trying to reach across the board and touch all the different, and you're very aware of what people who are 20, 30 years older might be thinking in their experiences. You also have to be very aware of how young people are digesting information and how did they want their information now. And so you got to be able to speak a lot of different languages.
Yeah, and I had a Neil Best, New York Sports Writer of the Year, on the show recently, and we did the whole episode talking about how the sports world is changing, whether it's Twitter, whether it's everything that we talked about, The Athletic a lot, ironically, because what they're doing is pretty crazy. And we talked about how it's changing and how, you know, you need to be able to talk to everyone and, you know, be able to talk to a young base. So it's really interesting, even though on the radio, you know, you have commuters, you have people listening, you know, from all different ages, on their phone or whatever, it's really, everyone needs to be able to be talked to because it's not like a TV show, as you said. And, you know, what you said about being old, I have a stat on my notes about in December of 2009, you became the third man in NBA history to call 1,000 NBA games before the age of 40. So you might feel old because you have the workload of like a 60 or 70-year-old because you've already called so many games, but really, you've done so much so young. So what has it been like to be able to get so much work done, do so much, you know, really young?
Yeah, I think people, you know, NBA years and going through this cycle, it's like they're like dog years, so you can really feel more like 89 or 46 or whatever. But yeah, I remember people bringing that up at the time. I'm like, I'm thinking, who's counting my games? Like, I'm not.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Who's got time to do that? That's pretty impressive. I'm probably not that far away from 2000 now.
Yeah, definitely.
Somebody else could do that, Matt. Not me. I was young. I was young. I recognize that now, how young I was, the things I was doing. I was very lucky. I was doing games on TV when I was 23 years old, and I was doing a lot of college hockey and hockey's game of the week when I was 26, and I was in the NBA at 27 or whatever. But when you're that age and you're just pushing for it, and it seems like you're old. It seems like, you know, it's happening slowly because you can't see what's in front of you. You don't know when you're walking home, like your dreams to do major league play-by-play, that job may be 3 days away, but you don't know that.
Exactly,
you've been just chasing it your quote-unquote whole life. no matter how long that is, you don't really have perspective when you're young as to how long it takes sometimes. So I do have, you have appreciation for that when people talk about, you know, it's been 20 years since this, or it's, you know, all of a sudden there was a, well, my break, if you, I mean, I had a lot of different things happen, but when I did my first NBA game, it was because the guy who did the Celtics couldn't get back from another gig, which is ironic, and that's ended up being my life, is doing, you know, two or three jobs at one time. Mm-hmm. He couldn't make it back from calling a football game, and I got the call at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to go over to the Garden, you know, in a snowstorm and do the Celtics game that night. And the 20th anniversary of that just passed, and that makes you feel old. I remember doing interviews for it because they did a feature on it. And my answer was, you know, people said, "Boy, I can't, it feels like yesterday." It doesn't feel like yesterday. It feels like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it was a long, you know, it was that amount of time. You just, I don't think, don't have perspective when you're in it. And the play-by-play life is a strange life that way. You're not working 9 to 5. You don't have Monday. Monday doesn't feel like Monday. Friday doesn't feel like Friday. Sunday doesn't feel like Sunday. Christmas certainly doesn't feel like Christmas. So I think you lose time that way. Also, you don't have the same, I remember I had a job, you know, I worked in radio and I had a Monday through Friday job and I remember what that felt like, but it's like losing a one of your senses that you don't use for 20 years where Friday feels like Friday and whatever. It's just a completely different, you know, different world. It's, you know, it's sort of a one long day that starts in September and ends in April or May or June, depending on how good the team is.
Mm-hmm. And the traveling too, the traveling's got to be crazy.
And it's it will beat you up if you don't love it.
Yep.
And, you know, my life changed, you know, 6 years ago when, you know, I had a son. And that has changed,
yeah.
You know, your desire or your tolerance for being on the road drops dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
When all of a sudden you can't see your, you know, like, you know, for a while, you know, my son, it's like I'm the iDad. You know, he just pops on the iPad in the morning and I can have breakfast with him and it's a great time to do this. Because my partner, Cedric Maxwell, when he was playing, he'd go on a two-week road trip, he might talk to his kids once, like on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. Whereas now I can see my son whenever I want to push a button and magically he appears. So it's great from that regard, but you also, you know, life happens and you don't want to miss it either.
Mm-hmm.
But particularly the last couple of years, like, you know, I left a job that I really enjoyed that I had become a big part of my life last year, leaving MMA and leaving a growing sport that had taken me all over the world because it had taken me all over the world. And
yeah.
I couldn't, I was just, it was just way too much time away from my son.
Mm-hmm.
and way too much work. And that's very counterintuitive to the 25-year-old me who just wanted to work all the time and do this and do that. All of a sudden, you know, there are things that are more important.
Yeah. On your Twitter, though, the pinned tweet, first thing I saw when I searched up your name, it is the video of your son popping up because he was getting egged on by Brad Stevens to do that. You mind
yeah,
just explaining that a little bit? That was Brad's fault?
Yeah, 100%. He completely did that.
That's
like,
hilarious.
You know, first of all, he thought that could distract me. He's going to be kidding me. He's better than that, coach. But, yeah, so I understand. And my son would have, because my son, you know, his whole life has been me doing something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's used to being on the air. He knows to be quiet. And, like, he's been trained from birth to be quiet while Dad's on the air. He knows how to do that. But, obviously, when Brad Stevens is telling him to jump up and down and do all this other stuff, he's going to be happy to.
You yeah,
know,
you
travel,
see,
travel that 5-year-old path and jump up and down.
That's hilarious. You see all over the NBA the players bringing their kids. So it is thankful that we're at a new time where you are able to see your kids, but your son. But you know, it is crazy to think about the world you live compared to the Monday to Friday job. So moving on to Cedric Maxwell, you did bring him up. I just want to talk about the history again that he brings. What is it like to work with someone almost every day with so much knowledge and such a great personality?
He's the reason. I mean, there are a lot of reasons it happened in 2001, but I think the turning point, I got offered the job about 3 times that spring when the Timberwolves season was over, and I turned it down all 3 times. I was doing TV. I was in Minnesota. I had 2 years left of my contract. I was doing college football at ABC. At that point, things were, you know, going well. I had no reason to come back, and there were 2 factors. You know, my wife at the time wanted to go back, and then when Max called me at my house, I remember that day sort of changing my thinking and going, you know what, this could be something. This could be, you know, more greater than the sum of the parts, like one of those teams that lasts a long time that people remember. And as you know, as fate would have it, I'm still with Max and no longer have the wife. So I think that was probably right. That was probably a good guess.
Yeah, and you and Max have been able to witness a lot. The Celtics have gone through a transformation, just like the world of journalism, but we'll talk about that later. But they've gone from the emergence of Paul Pierce, he started right when you started, the return of Danny Ainge, Doc Rivers' run in Boston, the World Championship, the Nets blockbuster trade, the Isaiah Thomas, Kyrie Irving trade. You've seen a lot. How fun has it been to cover such a unique team that really has made a lot of headlines?
I was pretty lucky because when I came in the league with Minnesota, they made the playoffs the first 3 years I was in, and now Celtics are in again. I think for me, this is 17 out of 20.
Wow.
Years in the league making the play, and that's
oh my God.
I think there's a lot of guys that don't, you know, that end up on teams that don't go to the playoffs and don't go far, and I've, you know, had the chance to do two NBA finals, and, you know, conference finals beyond that, and it's, you know, this is a very fortunate break. The Celtics, you know, pretty much got good when I got there, and then I'd been with Kevin Garnett for 3 years. All of a sudden, you're there when lightning strikes, and the Celtics overnight, you know, in 2007, go from, you know, from worst to first, and you're able, I was very much aware of what was happening when you're in it. Trick for a play-by-play guy is you can't be caught off guard. You sort of have to be very much in the time if you're going to document it for history. That's sort of the irony. You can't. You have to be very much aware as a season is unfolding like that. You're going to remember the 30 years from now, people are going to be talking about that season and mm-hmm. some of these things that are happening, and you got to be very aware of that. And that's sort of, I think, the beauty of the job is that when you go to the ballpark, you don't know. That night could be one of those nights that people will be talking about
yep.
for 30 years because someone's going to pitch a no-hitter, or someone's going to score 80 points, or someone's going to score 5 goals, or, you know, and some nights you know. Some nights you're walking in and it's a game 7.
Mm-hmm.
I got to call a game 7 of the NBA Finals sitting courtside with my buddy Doris Burke, and, you know, all through that series, we were sort of kicking each other out of the table, like, you believe where we are, where we're sitting, and she got up at the end of the first quarter to go interview Doc, and they were handing out the stat sheets, and I flipped mine over, and I drew two circles. I drew a big circle and then a little tiny dot in the middle of it. And I put it in front of her, and on the big circle, I put world, and the little dot, I wrote us, because we were at the center of the universe
wow.
for those 3 hours. It was like, this is game 7. Here we are. And you want to be aware of that, you know, when it's happening. But again, that's the beauty of it, is you just don't know. A lot of nights are just a lot of nights in the NBA. When you do however many games you're talking about, you do it, 1,900 games, most of them are not going to be memorable. But, you know, when you're calling a team that has Kyrie Irving on it, you know, that 50-point game could be coming
yeah.
out of nowhere. You know, that Golden State game, that Houston game, you know, sometimes you know it's going to be special, sometimes you just, you know, you walk into history and Karl Anthony Towns goes for 30 rebounds or something. You know, you got to be very much aware and then be able to make the broadcast entertaining
mm-hmm.
and to people and deliver it no matter what kind of game it is.
Yeah, and one thing that's really, really interesting is that if you were on TV, National would have come in and recorded the game. Well, I'm not sure what happened, but I was Howie Rose. He's the Islanders announcer, and when the Islanders made the playoffs, made it to the second round, he was down in Florida doing the Mets because he's no longer needed.
Yeah.
So one of the perks of radio is definitely you are there with the team for the long run. There's no national radio coming in to take your spot, which is really, really cool.
That is the clear perk of radio. And it's funny, Howie had one of the great, you know, for a long time, Howie had one of the great jobs that there was. Gary Dorn had it sort of the generation before, where you're doing the Mets and an NHL team at the same time. Gary Dorn was doing the Devils. We're talking about 30 years ago. And it's very much a thing that I'm aware of because there will come a day when, and we actually thought it was going to happen much, much sooner than this, where they were going to ask me to go on the TV. And if and when that day happens, that's something that I'm certainly going to want to address because there are some guys, I know Gary Cohen did it with the Mets or whatever, that, you know, that's something you want to put on the table and discuss, like
mm-hmm.
what happens when, you know, you don't want to get kicked out. And the NBA is the worst of all. I think it's like you could argue baseball, obviously, you do all the games all year and then get kicked out at the end. But basketball is tough for local teams with local rights because you're not just losing the playoffs in the second round. You're losing all the big games. You're losing the top games.
Yeah.
You get basically kicked out of the top 12 games of the year, and all the Celtics local teams maybe they get one game against Cleveland.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, the Celtics on the road trip a couple of weeks ago where they went, it was Houston, Chicago, and Minnesota, and TV only did the middle game.
Wow.
Of the trip. And then you're not only missing the big games, you're not really traveling with the team anymore, and you're kind of losing the point of being a team broadcaster in the first place.
Definitely. Howie Rose,
I did it my second year in the league in Minnesota. A very disconcerting thing happened with that. We got bumped out for TV, NBC back in the day, and you don't do the last game. And that's a very unsettling.
Yeah.
You do all the games all year, most of them, and then the last game comes. You don't know it's going to be the last game, and then you get eliminated, so you don't get to think about the audience or have any kind of clue. Very strange.
Yeah. Howie Rose cited that as one of the reasons, you know, his family as one of the reasons why he couldn't keep doing the double thing. And in hockey, you don't see getting kicked out as much as you would do in basketball. Basketball is always on. There's a bigger market for it. It's just a fact. And TV, you're always getting bumped. And it's just a shame. It's something that, you know, causes you to sigh. I feel like I'm in no position to say that, but it would be upsetting. And that's definitely one of the clear perks of radio. So,
yeah
so back to hockey, to those who are listening and, you know, wanting to hear what Mr. Grandy has to say about hockey. He has a lot to say about hockey, and I want to talk about it because you do the Celtics, but you do have a lot of history with the Frozen Four, with the Game of the Week, as you said. And hockey is something that has made you versatile. It's something that you do a lot. So how has that been able to be something that you really enjoy and have been able to keep up?
It was really my first love, and it's funny, last year was the first year since I was your age in high school before I started broadcasting. Last year was the first year I didn't do any hockey, and it was, I missed it horribly. As we're talking, earlier this afternoon, I was texting with a Division I coach just about a bunch of stuff and games and things like that, and, you know, this time of year, you really miss it. When the NCAA tournament is going on, you know, it's just something I could not continue to do at the time, you know, when I had to give it up after all the years of doing the Frozen Four. You know, I was doing MMA, and we were going overseas to do shows, and eventually you have to make choices
yeah.
different things you're going to do. And, hockey's just been a very big part of my life. So probably my first love is sports, what I always thought I would do. It is responsible. You know, college hockey, which is where my loyalty was, because that's why I always went back to the Frozen Four, because everything I ever did, the NBA job, getting to ABC at a crazy young age, all of that was from college hockey.
Oh, yeah.
It was college hockey work that got me those opportunities, and that's where I was able to, you know, it was a sport that I was able to give my best to, and it gave me a place, you know, sort of to be seen. And I thought, in this day and age in which everything is on TV all the time and there's no such thing as overexposure, to me, it remains the only thing that is sort of underappreciated or undercovered.
Exactly.
Or, you know, whatever. And then, you know, you're in New York. I grew up in New York. I didn't know anything about college hockey. I knew nothing. I remember that you'd have the national championship game would be on ESPN every year, and you might watch it because it went overtime or something like that. But until I set foot on a campus at Boston University, I didn't know anything about college hockey. And it became a monstrous part of my life. Like, you know, once I went to the NBA, not as much. I would do hockey, you know, do a little bit here, a little bit there. But I would say in the 90s, college hockey was my thing. And, you know, you're on the Hobey Baker committee, and eventually became the voice of the Frozen Four. I did BU hockey. I did BC hockey. I did Hockey East Game of the Week. And it was just, you know, something that I deeply loved. And I really thought, until the day I set foot in the NBA, I would have bet anything, and most people would have, that the NHL was going to be where I would end up.
Yeah, and you really hit it right in the head. The next question I was going to ask was, college hockey really is underrated. On my show, Destination Hockey, I've talked about it maybe 5 minutes because just there's NHL, the Olympics currently just really shadow over college hockey. But you've been able to see a lot of great tournaments. You've been able to see a lot of up-and-coming stars rise through the ranks. What have been some of your favorite moments from covering the Frozen Four?
Well, it's fun. Today, when I was talking to this coach, we were talking about he has a coach on his staff who played for Boston University in 2009 when they won the championship. And that's probably the one that I remember one when I was in school on student radio. I called a very famous national championship game that allowed them to do the math real quick. Yeah, way before you were born. In 1991, it was a, and this is, I tell the story because it's a, where college hockey was at the time, but where it still is in so many ways in terms of coverage. It was at that point probably the greatest national championship game of all time. It was BU against Northern Michigan. A ton of guys went to the NHL and had big NHL careers that played in that game. BU had Sean McEachran, Tony Amonte. The first line was Sean McEachran, Tony Amonte, and Keith Tkachuk.
Wow.
That was the first line, yeah, for BU. Scott LaChance, who ended up being with the Islanders draft pick, top pick in the draft that year, was on that team. I think 16, 17 guys went pro. Ed Ronan won a Stanley Cup on that team. Actually, two guys played in the NHL had left the year before, Joe Sacco and Mike Sullivan. It was just, and the, North Michigan had Mark Beaufay, Dallas Drake, Billy Pye played pro hockey. Brad Marenko was an offensive loser in the league. Anyway, there were just a ton of pros. Obviously, you can see this is the kind of memory I have for things like this. I don't know where my car keys are, but I can run this game for you, start to finish. BU led 3-0. North Michigan led 6-3. BU scored 3 goals in the third period. 7-4, they had 3 goals in the final 8 minutes. They tied in the final minute and empty net. 7-7, triple overtime. Northern Michigan wins it. 8-7, and when you're doing games in school, you don't know if you'll never do a game your life ever again. So this is my whole life with this team. You're documenting every minute of, like, it's the end of the world, and this epic national championship game unfolds, and later you realize ESPN was broadcasting it, and as soon as that goal was scored, Duke had just beaten UNLV in the Final Four in basketball. This is when it used to go head-to-head, and they bailed out. Here's the greatest game in the history of the sport they're supposed to be covering. And they bailed out 30 seconds later just to get the Sports Center to talk about Duke.
Oh my God!
And won this game, and that was the, you know, the college hockey was always the, you know, the stepchild, and that's kind of the way it was. But 2009, it's funny, BU was in that game again. This time they won. BU scored 2 goals in the final minute. Matt Gilroy set up the Nick Bonino scored the tying goal. In the final minute, and then BU won the national championship in overtime, you know, scoring 2 goals in the final minute. You know, they were a great overtime game. It was just, it never, the Frozen Four never, ever, ever lets you down. The sport never lets you down, because you can think of, in the NHL, think of Game 7s. You think of great Game 7s that you can remember in your lifetime, my lifetime. In the NCAA tournament, college hockey, everything's a Game 7.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So you're taking the March Madness format of basketball, and you're applying it to hockey, where you can go to sudden, you know, which obviously is, you know, it, like Spinal Tap, it goes to 11. It's just a different, you know, it has a gear. Playoff hockey has a gear that other sports don't have. And you're talking to a, you know, now a 20-year NBA guy saying this. That's just, you know, the passion that college has. It was cool to do. You know, you don't root for anybody. But I had been around North Dakota. Had been that team that every year we get to the Frozen Four. Every year they lose. And
oh,
they would find a way to lose. And Boston College would beat them almost, you know, with those great teams that BC had. And then the last game, the last game I've done in hockey was them finally winning the national championship in 2016.
That's great.
It was, you know, some of the great players, you know, the Jonathan Taves and TJ Oshie that came through North Dakota, and they didn't win. I'd love to see more connectivity with college hockey. You know, when you see guys playing the NBA, you know right away, hey, Kyrie Irving went to Duke, Blake Griffin went to Oklahoma or whatever. I'd love to see that hammered home to where there's more connection made to Jonathan Taves went to North Dakota, TJ Oshie went to North Dakota, Nick Bonino went to Boston University, and so on. So, you know, obviously the Jack Eichel year, they made the Frozen Four that year, was one of the greatest games I've ever seen a college player play, semifinals. I'm old enough to have done Paul Kariya games.
Wow.
You know, he was probably the best college. Yeah, I know. Now you're thinking.
I remember the off the boards on the scoreboard of that game with him. He was just, he's just a great player. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So college hockey, really underrated. I feel like as a Islanders fan, the only time Islanders fans ever tune into college hockey is when we're missing out on top college hockey stars, whether it's Will Butcher, Alex Kerfoot. We're always like that on Twitter, that second or third team that always misses out. That seems to be, for a lot of fans, that's when all they tune into college hockey for, is when free agents come out and they want a player for their team. But the tournament,
that absolutely happens too. And there's that's the difference in the NHL draft, obviously, in the NBA draft, where when guys guys are coming, they're coming. Mm-hmm. And the NHL is actually a smarter way to do it. The NBA, I think, is going to, after many years of a lot of us talking about it, the NBA, I think, is going to at least explore this idea that the NHL has had for years.
Yeah, they've been talking about it.
You draft the guy, he's yours. And mm-hmm. he's better off staying in school, stays in school. And when he's done, then he turns pro. But, because, you know, it really has made a lot of sense, but it takes away from that. Let me look at the tournament because we've got the fifth pick in the draft and whatever, we already have this guy. But it's a way, you know, for certain players, if you have a player, oh, he's at, you know, who's the kid for? Is it Anders Lee, right? It was Notre Dame.
Yep, Anders Lee.
And, you know,
fifth round
pick. Right. Because, you know, there's ways to follow the players that are in school. It's easier now than it was when I was, you know, covering the sport, and when I was in school, because now you can find games. Now there's 800 channels on TV, and you can have the internet. If you want to watch, you know, the, Minnesota Ohio State hockey game, you can find a way to watch it now.
Oh yeah, streaming everything.
You know, in the old days, forget it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So definitely, hockey has changed. College hockey's still finding a way, though, to stay under the radar. And when you were growing up, you grew up in New York City. You were a Rangers fan, as you said. Must have been tough to be a fan of the inferior team in New York at that time.
You have no idea, because once you start piecing together my age, you'll realize the timing. I've got a twist on the story too, which is that it was my first sport. So this is like late 70s, and I was a little kid, mm-hmm. and I become a hockey fan. I become a Ranger fan. My mother was not a sports fan at all, didn't care about sports, whatever. Her son would eventually drag her, kicking and screaming. She'd have no choice but to start going to games or whatever. And for whatever reason, I don't know even to this day, because now we're talking almost 40 years ago when it happened, she became, because of some show I had on or some game I had on, she became enamored with a goaltender from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, by the name of Glenn Chigo-Resch.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, despite having no affiliation in sports or interest in it, she became a fan of the New York Islanders.
Yep.
In the late 70s.
Oh,
and when I was 7 years old or 8 years old in 1979, man, the world was my oyster. Sorry, Mom, that the Islanders lost again and that the Rangers are going to the Stanley Cup Finals. Little did I know what was about to happen and my tortured childhood of every single year. You know, just get not only having your heart broken, but watching, you know, your mother's team. And she became one of these fans from no interest to had to go, speaking of radio broadcast, she would have to, when things got tense in 82, they had a famous game against the Penguins when they were trailing at home in game five.
Oh, yeah.
Two goals. She would, and this became a habit of her, she would go hide. She couldn't watch. She'd go hide, turn on the radio on, Barry Landers, and go hide under her covers.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
She couldn't even take it. She couldn't even, you know, like, scared, get a dog. But nope, she had to go hide and just, like, you know, stick her head under the covers. That's how intense a fan she became. And when you invest that much, you get the payoff and year after year after year after year. There was nothing worse than 84 when the Rangers were up 2-1 and then lost the, you know, Dave Langevin beats Barry Beck. No, like, I'm over it, believe me. Dave Langevin takes out Barry Beck in game four, and then game five, you have the overtime game, and in which Ken Morrow tripped Larry Patey, and then there was like two penalties that should have been called. But I'm over it.
Oh, you said you wouldn't talk about that.
It's fine.
It's fine.
But it was, you know, you appreciate, and that, as a kid, it's awful to go through. And I took my son, he came on a trip to Toronto last month in May, and I was able to take him to the Hockey Hall of Fame. And he's looking at these, you know, the Brian Trotsky and Mike Botsy and Clark Gillies. And actually, you realize what an amazing... It's just one of the most amazing, probably most overlooked dynasties in modern sports history. You know, again, the NHL is a little different and being able to keep teams together, but...
Salary cap is tough.
My gosh. And then it almost, you know, obviously gets back to the finals in 84. You know, as an adult, you can look back and appreciate it, but my God, it was a horrible thing.
It's tough
thing to live through. And I said, here's the last story on the outer. So I mentioned Kenny before. A couple of years ago, I went to see Kenny. Doing a game and you're playing the Panthers, and I see him. It's at MSG, and we're hanging out in the booth, and I see Sam Rosen, who I got to work with on NHL radio, and the Florida Panthers are there. So the Florida Panthers analyst on TV,
poppin'.
I got to meet as well, and so here I am introduced in a spot fan, and I had to apologize to him for anything my 9-year-old self may have said in that building many years earlier. But that's an amazing thing. This doesn't happen in other sports. Dennis Potvin still gets booed, and there's still Dennis Potvin chants whenever
that happens. Yeah, Potvin saw every game.
That wouldn't happen in other sports. I mean, I lived through that stuff. I remember that. Oh, Nielsen was like my favorite player.
They still chant that every game. The Rangers fans chant that.
And it is really, again, this is why you're kind of like, you've almost like, you're like resuscitating my hockey, my hockey life, which has just been sort of on, not life support, but it's frozen. It's like,
frozen four.
Frozen, to be, hopefully to be reanimated one day, but.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, that was my, but you know what? I guess here's the lesson of the whole thing. I knew this was going to be my life. Even these things resonated with me then, to the point I can still talk about them as if they were yesterday, almost 40 years later. This was what my life was going to be. And, when I say to kids that this is your dream and this is where you feel you belong, and you got to, you have to go for it. Mm-hmm. And, I had a backup plan out of school. I'd go do this for a couple of years and then try to get a real job or go to law school or do something.
Yeah.
But you got to take a shot at it if it's part of you.
Yeah. It's crazy that you brought that up. I was talking to Patrick Dowd, who is the Islanders super fan. I'm not sure if the Celtics have one, but if a lot of fan bases have this one fan that's, famous across the entire base, where he's the guy. He's the guy that people take pictures with at games. He's the he's the guy. And I had the honor of interviewing him last week, and he had a very similar story to your mom, where he was taken to a Rangers game. And he was, supposed to be a Rangers fan. And basically, he became an Islanders fan. He became enamored with that fan base, with that team. And it was one of the best decisions he ever made. He's still an Islanders fan to this day. And he got to live through the dynasty. And the Islanders just kind of grabbed Rangers fans and just grabbed the city. And even though they were on Long Island, in Uniondale, they took the state and eventually the country by storm and created one of the best dynasties. That was crazy to witness. I could not imagine being a Rangers fan. But to be honest, the Penguins right now, they're kind of similar. I hate watching them win.
Yeah, I'm sure. I feel bad about the whole, I don't know how general the average Islander fan feels about it. I'm not as connected, obviously, as I was. I feel bad the Brooklyn thing didn't work out.
Oh, it's terrible.
I do want to go see a game there before they move, because I remember, I think I went to one Islander game. I'll tell you exactly what I saw. It was kind of interesting. But for a kid from Manhattan, from mm-hmm. Greenwich Village, and obviously we don't have cars. The cars don't exist when you grow up in Manhattan. There's no cars.
Yeah.
So to get to the Nassau Coliseum was like going to Mars.
Exactly. That's what Barclays Center is like.
Right. From Long Island. But again, if you're my life was public transportation. Mm-hmm. To me, having the Islanders play, I used to go, and it was really much harder. Take a bus. I remember going to Devils games when they first moved when I was a kid, because you could get tickets. Rangers, mm-hmm. you couldn't. I mean, again, Kenny Albert and I have had this talk before about he turns his head sideways when you're talking about trying to get tickets, what it was like for Ranger fans, because some of us didn't grow up on the inside. We mm-hmm. had to wait in long lines to get tickets, and you could never get to a good game. I remember going with my dad or my mom on a pilgrimage. We saw the Soviets play when they were on their tour before Lake Placid.
Wow.
They played some NHL teams, including the Islanders, and that's a game I saw. Remember, they beat the Islanders, too. That was the team
I read about that. Islanders. That's crazy.
Win the first cup, 1979, I thought, right around that Christmas vacation time. But you could, be a New Yorker and get to the Nassau Coliseum was just impossible. You're thinking, two subways to get to Grand Central to take the Long Island Railroad, and, it seemed like it took a week to get there. It was just, an impossible thing. But, again, they might as well have been that far away. So I thought it was really cool to be in the city, because then that would have been something. If the Islanders had played at Barclays Center when I was a kid, I probably would have gotten a lot more Islanders games. But, it's probably best, if the team belongs to Long Island, and if everybody's happier with them out there, then
yeah,
so be it.
I know you're active on Twitter. Islanders, the Islanders have season, just whether it's John Tavares re-signing, the billboards, the Barclays Center, Brett Yormark, it's been absolute madness. And the Islanders fan base right now is like it's like that SpongeBob scene where the 100 SpongeBobs are running around in the fire. The kids would remember that. It's like chaos right now. It's terrible. And the Islanders went from being like a historic franchise to now it's unfortunate. A lot of positives. We're going back to the Coliseum. We're going back to Long Island. But right now, the Islanders, it's really reversed. The Islanders are in tough shape right now, which is unfortunate. But that's what it's come to. So NHL, NBA, that's what you do. I just want to ask, I'm not going to ask which one you like better, although you kind of have answered that a little bit. But what are the perks of each game? What's your favorite part about covering each game? And where have you found your niches kind of in each game, you know, covering each one?
Well, I'll say this. The thing, in some ways, I felt the most at home doing, and I had very, you know, again, you choose your path. But 5 years ago now, I got to do a bunch of Red Sox games, filling in for Dave O'Brien.
Yeah.
Doing ESPN. I couldn't do it for a lot of years because basically when Dave O'Brien first came and he would miss 25 games or whatever a year, it coincided with the Celtics getting very good. Kevin Garnett, whatever, and they were playing until the end of June. And that, you know, baseball season was half over. But the last year, Celtics went out pretty quick, and I was able to do it. And that was where I probably felt most at home, because I wasn't going to be the voice of the Rangers when I was a kid. I was going to be the voice of the Mets. I mean, that was sort of my, Howie's about 15, 20 years older than me. I'm not exactly sure, but that was the exact same path. Like Howie Roseman, that was like the dream, my dream.
Wow.
Growing up Mets fan or Ranger fan. So I used to answer that question. People say, what do you like doing most? I would say the one I'm not doing. Like, I miss, if I'm not from doing basketball, I miss hockey. If I'm on this baseball, yeah. I'm not doing it because the other season. I don't think there's one more than the other. I enjoy the events. When I went to do MMA, I was starting completely from scratch. It's a brand new sport, and now I really miss it. I miss it. I had to give it up. Now I've tried doing a little boxing, whatever. I love telling stories. I love calling games and calling events and telling the story of the fighter or the players or the athletes or whatever it is. And that is that's the treat. So I like to work is the answer. I like doing what I do. And I can't sing or dance.
Yeah.
What I did.
It's a lot of fun. Covering so many sports, it really must be a dream to be able to get to know so many people. That must be great, getting to meet all these past legends that get into broadcast journalism. It must be just great to be able to almost tour every sport. And, baseball is a different type of game. It's a little slower. It's a lot more talking, telling stories, as you say. So that's really something that, maybe – you never know, like the whole two season thing, you say your son, but Howie Rose is like the dream, what he did, as me, like just dreaming of that. That's cool. So, that's
and
really.
I don't think Howie gets enough credit. I don't think Kenny gets enough credit.
Yeah.
You made a reference to the versatility. I think if you can do hockey and baseball, that pretty much runs the game. I mean, that's a pretty
that's
wide
the two,
variety.
Yeah,
right?
That's the two extremes.
John McDonough. I mean, there's different guys that do that, but there's a lot of guys that do basketball and football.
Mm-hmm.
But throw in the other two, that's a different. Now you're going, like, basketball and football would be more towards the middle, and then put baseball on one side, and hockey on the other. I think hockey and basketball are not as dissimilar as people think they are.
Yeah, just because they play in the same arena
on radio
doesn't mean anything.
Because a lot more things happen in basketball than you think. And hockey, a lot of people say to me, I could never do hockey, it's impossible. Well, if you didn't grow up a hockey person, I can see why you'd say that. It's what comes natural to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you find someone that can do, I just have great admiration for that. To me, is the true skill of this particular field, of this skill set, of this art, of this art form. Is being able to do all the different sports at the right, at the right cadence to be able to do them the way they should be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's not you in a sport. You are acclimating to where you are. It's not you doing the same job and whatever it is you're calling. It's being able to feel it. It's music.
Yeah.
And if you can play, can you play jazz? Can you rap?
Yeah.
Are there musicians that can do both? Probably, but not very many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are the true gems. So, final question before I let you go. You went to Boston University. You talked about the great hockey tradition there. But just in terms of education, how did that prepare you for where you are today and possibly open the door to a return to Boston, where you've been so active with the Celtics, the Frozen Four in the Philadelphia area, Comcast, NBC, even spots on ESPN in Connecticut. Just how has Boston University really set you up for where you are?
I think Boston was a great place to be in school. I think I go back and forth on this. I majored in broadcast journalism. I do not recommend that. That's not necessarily a bad thing to do, but I tell people to get the best education you can get and find your opportunities interning or whatever outside of your education. You know, I wish if I had to do it over again, I would have gotten a better all-around education and been able to hold my own at a cocktail party probably better than I can than study. Because I think, you know, that you learn by doing in your field. And I think an education is something you're not necessarily going to get another opportunity to have, particularly if you just sort of start taking off, you know, in your old field. But Boston was a place to be because there were all those places that you could work and you could intern that were very valuable to me. My choice was between Boston University. It came down for me. There were a bunch of schools, but it was clearly going to be Boston University or the place that everybody else who wants to do what I do went, which is Syracuse.
Yep.
And I chose BU because I just thought everybody that wants to do what I do is going to Syracuse. And does that mean that I might get to do one volleyball game my junior year? Like that, I remember that was sort of my thinking at the time. It's like, do I
want
to
really go interesting
where everybody else wants to go? And then the other mistake the tour guy made is I remember going there at 17 years old on campus in April, and it was a spectacular day, and it was 75 degrees, and the Carrier Dome was there, and like, my God, this is perfect. And I'm seeing college girls walking around for the first time. And I'm like, this is heaven. And one of the parents asked the tour guide, do the students always gather like this and play hacky sack on the quad or whatever? And the tour guide made the biggest tour guide mistake of all time and said, well, this is the first day it hasn't snowed since October. So, you know, I don't really. And that was pretty much the end of, yeah, I was pretty much BU all the way.
Yeah, I'm looking at Syracuse. There's a lot of things to keep in mind. I had a very similar experience. Perfect day. Went in the summer to tour. I loved it, but Syracuse isn't that area, that rich market that Boston is. I talked to David Fine, who is the announcer for the WHL team, I think, of the Flyers. I met him at an Islanders game, and coincidentally, we hit it off. And he said that the Syracuse Crunch, it's like a bloodbath for whoever can intern at that. Like, that's literally all they have in terms of sports broadcasting. And he said it's like a fight. It's like people are punching and kicking each other to get the three interns positions they have there because it's really tough. So that's interesting you said that.
Listen, I got a million friends, and they all want to going to be, you know, if this ever gets back to them, and they'll be like, McDonough, Tarico will be texting me, whatever, going, Syracuse, I get it, blah, 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 Syracuse. But that was it. You know, it's not for, listen, it's a great school. Obviously, it's produced some of the greats in my field.
Mm-hmm.
But that was my thinking. And again, going back to what I was saying, there are places to intern everywhere if you really go after it. So my feeling is get the best education you can get. Also because, as I said at the start, there's only two jobs for the voice of the Boston Red Sox available. And there's, as you say this many times, there are a lot more jobs for players in the major leagues than there are for broadcasters. So it is not easy. Not something you can guarantee you're going to get. So have something to fall back on.
Yeah. Great advice. All the young people listening, you know, it was great to talk to Sean Grandy about these, you know, the broadcast journalism world, also all the experience he has and being versatile and how important that is. So it was great to speak with him. It was an honor, and I'm so thankful you were able to give up some time out of your busy schedule to come on the show. Again, this is Destination Hockey. I'm your host, Dave Lazar, and it was an honor to talk to Sean Grandy. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
All right, have a great day, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.